First case on calendar this morning is 71516, Bowser, Terrence Bowser versus State. The appellant is ready to proceed. Please do so. If you wish to reserve any time, so state. And for the record, Justice Sherry will not be participating in this matter.
All right, appreciate it. Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Jamie Resch. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Terrence Bowser. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I'm glad we have an opportunity to argue this case because it's potentially complicated and it's made worse by the fact the Court of Appeals below, the parties, even myself, I would include myself in that, have interchangeably used the concepts of due process and double jeopardy at times. And while that may not affect the outcome, the ultimate outcome of the case, it could potentially affect the route that we get there. So what I'd like to do is split those concepts up, talk about them individually, and see how they relate to Mr. Bowser's claims before this court. Starting with double jeopardy. And when I say that, I mean double jeopardy under the Nevada Constitution, as explained in this court's decisions in Dolby and Wilson, which have been briefed extensively by the parties. The dissent below cited Wilson as part of the basis for its determination of relief. And what I'm asking here today is that this court more clearly extend the holding in Wilson to encompass Mr. Bowser's situation. And that's important because, viewed as a question of double jeopardy, we wouldn't even reach the issue of whether or not there was vindictiveness in the increase in his sentences. It would be a straight question of, were the sentences increased after they were originally imposed? In that regard, we would have all the record that we need in order to determine that question. One would just
compare. Counsel, I have a question for you and your opponent.
Okay.
We're here talking about the imposition of a harsher sentence, yet no one bothered to brief the question. When conducting an evaluation of whether a harsher sentence has been imposed following a new trial on remand, should the court look at the former sentence and the current sentence in the aggregate or on a per count basis? We make the assumption in these arguments that the sentence is harsher. There's a lot of law out there about whether we look at these sentences in the aggregate or on a per count basis before we ever, it seems to me, begin to evaluate vindictiveness or other issues that are raised in these briefs.
Of course. And if the sentence wasn't harsher, then it would be hard for me to make a claim under either of those provisions.
So why is it harsher?
Well, there's a couple reasons.
Or do you folks want to brief this question?
Well, I feel that we did, and I'm referencing the supplemental brief that was filed after the petition was granted. I included an entire section on why the court below, and I'm speaking specifically of the concurring opinion, felt raised some of the issues that you are raising, why that wasn't correct. There were some circuit cases that were cited that specifically mentioned rejected the aggregation defense, we'll call it. But
as we're not bound by what the Court of Appeals has done, that's why you're here today.
Oh, of course, and that's the good news for me, frankly. But this court's prior decision in Wilson squarely addressed this question and ultimately, I thought, flatly rejected, at least as far as Nevada goes, the concept that we're going to aggregate sentences and look at the ultimate outcome. The holding of Wilson, I thought, was quite clear that we're going to look at each individual sentence here in Nevada and determine if it's harsher or less harsh than the sentence that was previously imposed.
That didn't specifically, isn't that distinguishable? It specifically didn't apply to a retrial.
Well, the situation before the court in Wilson did not involve a retrial. That much is true. But I am here to suggest that we should certainly extend those protections to the potential situation of a new retrial rather than just a resentencing. There's a couple of reasons for this, and it's a little convoluted, but I will do my very best with it. The court in Wilson, and this wasn't that long ago, 10 years ago, some of the members from that court are still in the court here today, determined that Nevada is going to have stronger double jeopardy protections than exist under federal law. And to determine what those stronger protections were, the court in Wilson looked to much older Supreme Court decisions from the turn of the last century, ex parte Lange and U.S. v. Benz, cases from around the 1900s that did provide some protections, including, I would suggest, a protection that would encompass, under the Double Jeopardy Clause at the federal level, a protection if a sentence is increased after a retrial, after the defendant has begun serving it. And I guess that's my whole point here today, that, sure, the feds do not follow that process anymore. I think Pierce quite clearly rejected on double jeopardy grounds the whole concept that a sentence cannot be increased after retrial. But there was a time under federal law when that wasn't the case. And the whole point of Wilson was to preserve those strong protections under cases like Lange and Benz and to provide those protections to combatants at the current time. And guess what? One of those protections was that the penalty on retrial could not exceed the penalty imposed at the first trial. You don't have to take my word for this. It's explained in detail in the concurring opinion in Pierce. And I would never suggest that I could say it any better than William Douglas or Thurgood Marshall did, but it came down to the concept that the state should not be allowed to benefit from trial error, even to the extent that it could include having a second opportunity to increase the penalty that a criminal defendant has suffered after a first trial. So for those reasons, certainly, I understand the distinction between Wilson, it was pointed out by the concurring opinion, and this court obviously recognizes it as well. But the cases that this court relied on in Wilson are the same exact cases that the concurring opinion in Pierce relied on to determine that a stronger protection did exist at one point in time. And if we're being consistent with this court's holding in Wilson, there would be no reason not to conclude that protection exists at the current time, extended to Mr. Bowser's situation. Which is why I'm suggesting in the first part of my argument that double jeopardy protections should apply. If we go off of Wilson, we can see that specifically, if we're looking at each individual sentence, there's no doubt in this case that his counts 4 and 6 are more detrimental to him at the current time than they were at the previous time after the first sentence. Now they're consecutive, of course.
Why aren't we just evaluating this as a due process issue under Holbrook and applying Holbrook? And if we apply Holbrook in that standard, where are we?
Well, and that's, of course, the other way of looking at this, and Holbrook largely follows Pierce, and I think the due process question, whether you're at the state or federal level, is largely similar. Again, the dissent cited Holbrook and appeared to simply decide the case on due process grounds, and certainly the court would be entitled to do that here today as well. If we were going to do that, then the first step should have been below and should be here today to determine if a presumption of vindictiveness even applies. And the answer to that question has to be a resounding yes. How can I be so sure? Well, take a look at what other recent courts are doing. State Supreme Courts, such as in Oregon, with the Sierra case that the state has relied upon. I myself, a bigger fan of the Fourth Circuit in the Austin v. Plumlee case that I've cited and relied on extensively. In that case, the Fourth Circuit granted federal habeas relief to a criminal defendant. And that result was ultimately, well, certiorari was denied by the U.S. Supreme Court. So for whatever it's worth, there was an opportunity to correct that if it was incorrect and that didn't happen. The point being, the only way a federal circuit court could have granted federal habeas relief based on North Carolina v. Pierce is if that law is clearly established. And that happened just 3 years ago. And I would say that definitively answers the question of whether or not there should be a presumption of vindictiveness or whether or not the Court of Appeals was correct below when it suggested that Pierce might have been overruled. It clearly has not been. And the question of whether or not the presumption should apply, I guess this strikes me as a little bit of the cart before the horse argument. The court below seemed to suggest, well, we don't have the PSI or all these other records that we may need, so how can we determine if the presumption applies? Well, that's the wrong way of looking at the issue. The question should instead be, under Pierce, what was the procedural standpoint under which the newly imposed sentence occurred? And Pierce informs quite directly that under the situation of a retrial where a harsher sentence is imposed, the presumption of vindictiveness applies. You don't need the so-called expanded record or to rule out everything possible under the sun, and it wouldn't make sense to do that anyway.
You're talking about the cart before the horse, but going back to Justice Hardesty's comment, don't you first have to determine if the sentence was harsher, looking at an aggregate approach or an aggregate remainder approach?
Again, sure, there wouldn't be a presumption of vindictiveness unless there was a harsher sentence to look at.
So what did you demonstrate in this case that would support that argument that it was a harsher sentence?
Again, I would hearken back to the court's decision in Wilson, where I think quite clearly this court determined that we look at individual sentences, the manner in which they're imposed. Federal circuits have looked at whether or not a sentence has changed from concurrent to consecutive. And based on all those factors, specifically in Mr. Bowser's case, counts 4 and 6 were not only were the duration increased, specifically on the bottom end before there would be parole eligibility, but they were also run consecutive to his other counts, whereas at the first trial they were concurrent to his other counts. So that's the big thing that's disadvantaging Mr. Bowser in this particular case. And I would suggest under Wilson, very clearly that is an increase in his sentence.
But you've talked about vindictiveness, and you've talked about wanting us to jump to a presumption. In the second trial, we have a new judge, a new prosecutor. We have a fresh judge. So what is vindictive about this judge versus the first judge?
Okay, I understand that, and that was sort of the Court of Appeals position. I would urge the court, give a good read to the Sierra case that the state cited. It goes into detail about that exact issue. And factors regarding changes in the defendant, changes in court personnel, these are not the things that the U.S. Supreme Court has ever held are relevant to the question of presumption of vindictiveness.
But have they thrown them out, since you're asking us to look at this anew?
Well, in Pierce, the sentence was imposed anew. I mean, unfortunately, that's the most analogous case there is. In Pierce, there was a original sentence imposed, a retrial, and a harsher sentence imposed. And the Supreme Court said that violates the presumption of vindictiveness.
But wasn't that with the same judge?
It was a different judge. One can readily go back into Pierce, review the history of the case. The state Supreme Court decision in that case was a different judge. And the Sierra case goes into great detail about that particular fact. So I don't believe that a change in judge is relevant to the question of whether there's a presumption of vindictiveness. The question is, for the presumption to apply, what is the procedural posture of the case? And that is where the Supreme Court has outlined various, what we see is it appears to be an eroding standard of vindictiveness. But one thing that has never changed is that if there's a retrial and there's a harsher sentence, there's a presumption. And the presumption has to be rebutted either by the trial court itself or the state. No court has ever placed that burden on the defendant like is being done by the Court of Appeals below here today or here in the past, which is why I'm here today to suggest that if there was a burden to rebut, it belonged to the state or to the trial court, never to the defense. And it wouldn't make sense to even do that. The way of rebutting that presumption, if it did exist, would be to point out, and this is the words the Supreme Court used, objective information concerning identifiable conduct by the defendant after the first sentencing. It wouldn't even make sense to place that burden on the defense counsel to find negative things which justify the increased sentence. That's a job for the state.
You do agree, though, that judged, comparing them in the aggregate, he did not receive a harsher sentence the second time around, because the first time it was life with the possibility of parole after 40 years, and then the second sentence was 30 years with the possibility of parole after 12. So if we went with the aggregate approach, all of this doesn't matter, right?
It would be a challenge to say, of course, a life sentence about the longest sentence that could have been imposed, and certainly he's not serving that anymore, of course.
Do you agree with those numbers if we just try to aggregate them?
Well, as a base matter of comparison, sure. I can't argue that a sentence of years is less than a sentence of life. Of course not. But on the other hand, redirecting this court to Wilson, we've already determined here in Nevada we're going to look at individual sentences, not at the aggregate total.
Counsel, you're at your three-minute mark. If you wish to reserve it otherwise, you'll be using up your time.
I do. And thank you. I will reserve the rest of my time. Appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Justices. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. My name is Jake Filani. I will be representing the State of Nevada respondent in this case. I was also trial counsel below, and I argued the sentencing in this case.
Mr. Filani, you've heard the arguments raised by counsel. Why is not Wilson controlling?
Why is Wilson not controlling? It's because Wilson had to do with the overturning of an illegal sentence as opposed to the retrying of an entire case. And that's the same thing with Dolby. And this Court's analysis in those cases was solely that the counts were overturned, resentencing was ordered, and then the judge increased the resentencing on those counts which were not overturned. There's your level of vindictiveness. And in all of this, I'd remind us that that's what we're looking at. We're looking at the vindictiveness of the trial judge. Our worry is that the trial judge will get another shot at this and punish the defendant because he's exercised his appellate rights.
Are you conceding that Mr. Bowser got a harsher sentence than the prior sentence?
No, absolutely not, Justice Hardesty. Well, and if it weren't for Justice Douglas's question, that was going to be my first point, because that is my first point written down, is this is not a harsher sentence unless you take it count by count. Now,
why shouldn't we do that, particularly in a case like this, where he was acquitted of first-degree murder and found guilty of involuntary manslaughter? So comparing the aggregate sentences before and after seems inappropriate.
Well, because trials are complex things, as you well know, Justice Hardesty, and they are very fact-based things. And We have boots on the ground for these things. These are our district court judges. We have people who have heard the emotional testimony. We have district court judges who have heard every witness in this case. And I think it's a big stretch to say Judge Kadish, the reason that she ran one of those counts consecutive and didn't even max him out on it. Her sentence was 4 to 10 when her range was 2 to 15. Didn't max him out on the discharging, but ran it consecutive to the voluntary with use. She was there. You got to remember, and there were a bunch of differences, as Judge Tao noted in his concurrence.
The only thing that Holbrook requires is that she state on the record why she imposed. I should say, I don't mean to personalize this to her, just a judge, period, would impose a sentence that runs consecutive instead of concurrent for being found guilty for the exact same counts.
Correct, Your Honor. Holbrook v. State is a 1974 opinion. It was made 1 year after the Pierce decision. The Pierce decision was clarified in 1989 by Alabama v. Smith, by our Supreme Court, when they said, look, we didn't mean to lay down a hard-line rule that there is this presumption of vindictiveness. This is a case-by-case analysis. Another case, Texas v. McCullough, has a statement that I believe is right to your question. The vindictiveness presumption is also inapplicable because different sentencers assess the varying sentences that McCullough received. In such circumstance, a sentence increase, quote, cannot truly be said to have taken place. We recognize that when different sentencers are involved, it may often be that the second sentencer will impose a punishment more severe than the one received by the first, but it no more follows that such a sentence is a vindictive penalty for seeking a new trial than that the first sentencer imposed a lenient penalty. And that's what I think we're dealing with here. You can no more say that Judge Kadish meant to punish this man for going forward with his appeal than you can say that Judge Gates meant to take it easy on this man, given that he would just receive a sentence of 40 to life from a jury. Continuing on, counsel raised the Sierra case. Sierra case is an Oregon case from 2017. It's important to remember that Oregon used to not allow any sentence increases on retrial. The underlying law then changed, and a subsequent court decision made it so they could increase sentences so long as those reasons for increase were put on the record. Here, I would beg the court to look at Judge Kadish's actual statements here, because she did give a preamble to her sentencing in this case. And sorry, I'm dealing with a few papers. When Judge Kadish sentenced the defendant, she said, "So, Mr. Bowser, I hope that after going through all this process, you truly understand the great loss that was caused by the choices you made and the actions you took that day. Mr. McCoy didn't have an opportunity to make choices in this situation, but you did, and that's what brings us here today. I do. I respect the jury verdict. I respect that their evaluation of the evidence and the verdict that they returned, and certainly take all that into account, as well as all the information in the PSI and what's presented here today by your counsel in evaluating what an appropriate sentence is in these circumstances." And as the counsel who did the sentencing in this case, Justices, I can tell you that I raised additional issues that likely weren't raised when he was sentenced to 40 to life previously. I pulled the citation that he received 5 months earlier for driving around with a loaded shotgun in his car and had his shotgun taken away, the matching shotgun to his co-defendant, which they eventually killed Mr. McCoy with. There were also three victim speakers. The Oregon court recognized that, look, the continuance of victim speakers, this is continually affecting their lives, and that can be a basis for raising the sentence there as well.
But shouldn't Judge Kadish or whoever the judge is have identified why on those two counts, same two counts, apples to apples, why on after a retrial, just incumbent under Holbrook for her to identify on those discharging counts, now I'm going to give you more time, and here's why. I mean, it's not a high burden. What's the difference between back then and now?
I think we're presuming that Judge Kadish would be on notice that she was somehow being vindictive. I think, like I did, Judge Kadish saw this as a completely new trial. There were new attorneys. There was new evidence. For the first trial, the defendant conceded to second-degree murder, said, "I was trying to shoot the car, not the person within the car," and they went forward with that argument. This trial, they said it was a coerced confession. Judge Kadish was trying a completely different case than Judge Gates did, and I don't know that she even went back and looked at the PSI. She noted in the record that she hadn't read the transcripts from the previous trial. We were going argument by argument. There were new arguments raised. There was new evidence admitted that wasn't admitted in the first trial. So I think that's the reason why it didn't occur to her that, hey, you know, I should protect myself from a vindictiveness analysis, because there was really no reason to assume that she was being vindictive in this case. Going on, so there were some differences, as Judge Tao noted. I would like to raise a couple different ones. We've noted the different judges, the different attorneys in this case. It's also significant that the sentencing argument varied, because this was a it varied from the first sentencing because the sentence was so very different. This was a sentence that actually Judge Kadish had discretion on with the voluntary manslaughter with use of a deadly weapon.
Why in your estimation, was the in light of the fact that you had a second-degree murder, then you had a manslaughter conviction, and two unlawful discharges. Right. On this record, why in your estimation were the unlawful discharges worth more the second time around?
Well, because, see, we're trying to interpret what the jury meant to do here. I guess it's an odd case because they found him not guilty on the conspiracies, found him guilty on the dischargings. I think one form of analysis could be that, look, if you're looking at this as a voluntary manslaughter, he was somehow angered by this other driver, be it road rage, which is what they kind of went with their defense. Because he used his shotgun in that manner as a response to road rage, right? There's this anger that he can't control, and he pulls out a loaded shotgun, shoots from a moving vehicle into another moving vehicle, endangering other lives. That's different than the first-degree murder conviction, where he planned to go out, kill somebody. In that sort of circumstance, that shotgun is just a means to an end. If I'm going to kill somebody, I'm grabbing the shotgun. So I think.
So wait, if you intended to kill somebody in the first trials, the evidence was
correct,
and you discharged a shotgun twice.
Right.
Those discharges are worth less than the second time around, getting mad and discharging the shotgun.
I'm saying this is a form of the analysis that could be undertaken. And look, when you intend to go out and kill. And we're not saying that he didn't intend under the voluntary manslaughter statute. We're saying he was angered through the road rage. When you intend to go out and kill somebody, the shotgun's a means to an end. The shotgun was taken care of with the equal and consecutive sentence for use of a deadly weapon under his conviction before. Now, when we move forward in voluntary manslaughter, it's a completely different analysis. If we're to take the jury and believe that this isn't a compromise verdict, which I believe it was, this was a horse trading verdict. I don't think there's any other way to explain that. But that'd be my answer to you, Mrs. Stiglitz.
Do you agree if we apply Holbrook, the court needed to state reasons?
If you go by Holbrook, yes. But I also think this court needs to take into account that Holbrook is old law. Holbrook was decided a year after the Pierce decision. The Pierce decision has been clarified by our Supreme Court. There's been subsequent.
When you say our Supreme Court, you're saying the United States Supreme
Court.
Okay.
I say the Supreme Court. I apologize.
Right. But so Holbrook hasn't been addressed by this Nevada State Supreme Court.
Correct. Holbrook has not been modified by the Nevada Supreme Court to say you don't have to put those reasons on the record.
And this court doesn't have to modify Holbrook. You agree?
I agree. I do believe that Holbrook was the same sentencing judge, though, if I'm not mistaken, who went back and resentenced. I don't know if I have that noted or not, but that is another difference here, and that's where the McCullough decision comes in, is when you have a different sentencing judge, basically that it's washed clean. Why does Judge Kadish somehow feel the need to punish this man for...
You agree, though, if in an aggregate sense, let's say he was convicted of all the same crimes, even though a different judge was doing the second sentencing, you agree that judge couldn't sentence greater, right? New judge, according to your theory, judge, you think they could sentence greater than the aggregate?
You're saying if he was convicted once again of first-degree murder and all the charges he was convicted for in the first
Could the sentence, second judge on the retrial sentence greater?
I believe the case law says that she can, as long as she puts those reasons on the record. And this
Now you're cycling back to Holbrook.
Well, but we're talking about aggregate sentences versus counts here. I'm cycling back to Holbrook.
Isn't that why it's necessary for this court to establish some law on what is the comparison that's to be made in these sentences, whether it's actually harsher or not?
Yes, I believe it is, Justice Hardesty. I think we could use some guidance on these points. What I would ask this court to do is trust your district court judges. Give them that. Let's not make a presumption that somebody's being vindictive just because the sentence is higher. Let's place that burden. And look, it could be done. What if she maxed him out on both counts, ran all three counts consecutive? Okay, then I think we can presume there may be a little bit of vindictiveness here. But in this case, there's really no reason to look back in the record and say, wow, you know, why did she do that? Because it's plain from the reading of the case, it's plain from the conviction on the other counts. I also like to bring to this court's attention something kind of odd with the procedure in this case, being that if you do decide to send this down and have Judge Kadish state her reasons on the record for her sentencing and go forward with a new sentencing, it's likely that it's not going to be Judge Kadish hearing this case again. That's a likely scenario anyway. Maybe Judge Kadish is sick on the day this comes up for sentencing, but in this particular case, it's likely that she's not going to be the judge, so we're going to be sending this down to a third judge.
Why wouldn't we just do like in Wilson and knock it down to the original sentence on those two counts?
Well, I would ask you not to do that because of the circumstances of the case, because of the facts. I mean, this was a horrific crime. These men decided to go out and they wanted to see what it was going to be like to shoot somebody or to shoot a car, depending on who you believe. And they got their ammo and they got their loaded shotgun and they went and they found this family man heading on the way home to his family, and they shot
him. That's not the legal standard, whether it's horrific or not. I mean, the rule's going to apply across the board.
They can.
So why wouldn't we do it like in Wilson, where we said it came back and just go back to the original sentence on the two counts?
Well, I think the Wilson analysis is different, Justice, because it had to do with the overturning of illegal sentences. That district court judge had no basis. I mean, we can presume that that was vindictive because what has changed when this court says you must throw out counts two and three and resentence on count one, and then count one is raised to match the sentence that he would receive on counts two and three. Anyway, that's vindictive. There's a presumption of vindictiveness there. Maybe a court can explain it, but they certainly should put it on the record. This is different when we have retrial. As the court said in... I believe it's Alabama v. Smith, where the slate was wiped clean upon a retrial. That's probably not the right case. Sorry. Oh, it's Chafin, the Georgia case in 1973 decided. The slate was wiped clean when the original conviction was overturned. So we're dealing with kind of a clean slate here.
For jeopardy purposes, I agree with you. But for due process purposes, on the retrial, we have some constraints.
Right. I don't think this affects the defendant's due process rights. He got his retrial. He got his sentence. His high end of his sentence is now 10 years less than the low end was before. He has received the benefit of the appellate process. Obviously, as an advocate of the state, I wish things were different, but they're not. And he received that benefit. And I go back to Justice Hardesty's point, and something I saw reading through this as well, is this is not a harsher penalty. And there's only one case throughout all the cases cited where we're actually looking at it count by count instead of aggregate sentence. Every single case, Pierce is actually two cases that were combined on the appellate review. McCulloch, Smith, every single case that has to do with a retrial is looking at the aggregate sentence. They weren't looking at a count-by-count sentence. The only case that was looking at a count-by-count sentence was Wilson. And that had to do with the vacation of the distribution of child pornography charges. I beg this court to affirm the Court of Appeals opinion. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Clerk, if you'd set the time at 3 minutes even.
Thank you. Well, lucky us. Here we are in Nevada. Wilson's a Nevada Supreme Court case. And so what can I say? If we found the one case that supports the argument that I'm making, that we look at the individual sentences, well, it's a Nevada Supreme Court case, and we're talking about a Nevada criminal defendant. There's no reason in the world not to apply Wilson to this case. And it wouldn't even make sense, the differentiation between aggregate sentences under due process or double jeopardy. Are we really going to have two different rules, whether these sentences are aggregated or looked at individually in Nevada? It would only make sense to have one rule, and that rule has already been established. We look at the individual sentences. Just to back up a step with something the state is arguing, let's depersonalize this just slightly. In Blackledge versus Perry, the Supreme Court explained we're not looking at the particular vindictiveness level of the individual judge. In fact, in that case, they said none of this requires that an actual retaliatory motive exist. The interests that are being protected by Pierce
which, by the way, is absolutely still good law, as we know from Plumlee versus Austin and its recent discussion thereof. The interests that are being discussed in Pierce are to combat institutional bias and to assure criminal defendants, both current and future, that exercising their right to an appeal will not be held against them. Those are the rights that we're protecting. We're not searching for an actual vindictive, a record of actual vindictiveness where there is a presumption of vindictiveness that would apply.
Is there something in the record that shows the court was held themselves out to attempt to punish the defendant?
Again, I will absolutely answer that. My first suggestion, again, though, is if there's a presumption of vindictiveness, it goes the other way. The state has to justify that sentence, not the other way around. If you were not to apply the presumption, then I suppose, sure, the alternative is the defendant would have the burden of proving actual vindictiveness. And so in this case, is there any evidence of that if we were to reach that more distant question? I think that there is. It absolutely has been established in the record. I have the same pages that the state
read
from.
Could you point something out?
What's that?
Could you point something out?
Yes, clearly established. It specifically is the fact that the only reason that we have at all from the sentencing record that the sentence was increased was that the state requested that it be. That was it. This was an effort to rebalance the sentence to get as close as possible to the original sentence. There isn't anything else that justifies it. You haven't heard one shred of evidence of something that arose after the first sentence, and that's the relevant time period. Nothing justifies the increased sentence except that, in the state's view, Mr. Bowser made off with a better result on appeal in the second instance, and they wanted to punish him as close as they could to the first sentence. That's precisely the situation in Pierce and why we have this presumption of vindictiveness. It should apply in this case. The court should find that the increased sentence is unconstitutional. Reset the same to the original levels in counts 4 and count 6 from the first trial. I'll submit it with that, unless there's any further questions. Thank you.
No questions. Thank you very much. We thank counsel for their arguments today to attempt to clarify this area of Nevada criminal law that seems to need clarifying. With that, this matter will stand submitted.